Hi, we have a very interesting guest on the podcast this week. Derek Fay has written a fascinating book about the history of telecoms in Ireland, and it's actually a very surprising history. It starts in the 1850s, when the first subsea cables were being laid, and Ireland was the natural hub for the first transatlantic cables. Later, Ireland's proximity to Nova Scotia made it the natural hub for the first Marconi radio services. We then talk about the state of telecoms during the rise of the new and, in fairness, not very well-off Irish state. And finally, we get on to the last decades when there was huge investment in telecoms and there was the tremendous growth of mobile and the internet, and Ireland became a leader in many ways. Derek is a great raconteur, and he tells a story with clarity and humour and insight, which I found fascinating. I couldn't quite find the music that Derek wanted, but you see I got a sort of close second to it. So enjoy. This is a great podcast.
Oh yeah, well, no, it was a setback, but I think it was just, you know, it certainly spawned a lot of companies because the engineering experience was great.
Yeah.
But so for I'm talking to Derek Fay, and Derek has written a fantastic book called Connecting a Nation: The Story of Telecommunications in Ireland, and it's a fantastically produced book. It's a good few hundred pages. It's the history of everything, and we're going to talk about that in a second. And fantastic illustrations. They're just probably one of the nicest books I've seen for a nerd like me in a long time. So, Derek, you know, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Not at all. Thanks for having me, Pat. And thank you for the compliments on the book.
Not at all. It's a really good, great piece of work. And we were just talking there. We're going to talk about maybe three areas. First of all, it may not be well known today, but at one stage, Ireland was a leader in global telecommunications. We'll get into that in a second. And then after the new state was formed, it was not well off, poor, and there was an underinvestment in telecoms for a long time. And then we're going to talk about the mobile era. So, Derek, you're the expert here. Why was Ireland the world leader in telecoms back in the 1800s?
It was largely geographical. So if you look at a map of the Atlantic, you know, basically Kerry and Newfoundland are the nearest points across the Atlantic. So if you're building a telegraph cable, and it's all very new, cutting edge stuff, insulation, which was made out of gutta percha, is relatively new. So constructing a cable of any length is all very new and risky. So you minimize your risk by making the cable short. And also the transmission, there was no amplification or anything available at the time. So your transmission loss increased with the length of the cable. So you wanted to minimize that and make sure the message was still, you know, understandable at the other end. So hence, Kerry basically became a global center for communications.
Well, and how long was the cable? Well, you wouldn't recall, would you?
They were in use for about 100 years.
Really?
So the first... the first successful one, I think, was 1866, and then I think it was closed in about 1965. Yeah. So,
go on. Are you serious?
Yeah,
that's amazing.
Yeah. And it was AT&T, I think, closed at the Valencia station in 1965, 1966. So, and they were an amazing employer because if you've, you know, obviously 1866, it was not that long. You're talking 20 years after the famine. The country side in particular is very poor. So suddenly to have this technological, you know, innovation appearing in the western part of Kerry, and it wasn't just Valencia. There was one in Waterville, and which did just different companies, and a smaller one in Ballinskellig. And you know, so between them, they were an important employer, a lot of money. And you know, initially people were largely immigrants. People were brought in who with that expertise. But they did employ locals, and locals became part of the technical staff. And so there are some quotes in there from people who are still alive who remember the last few years of the stations. And they said you wouldn't have found the like of it anywhere in Kerry, because the houses which still exist in Waterville and Valencia, you know, would have had running water and electricity and so on before anybody else in the locality.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. And I'm just amazed how long the cable was used for.
Yeah,
Sorry, go ahead, Eric.
No, I mean they did last. There were several laid. There was a flurry of building really up to about 1920. Then what happened was partly, I suppose, other routes, you know, became available and so on. But also technology meant that you could basically a form of initially mechanical multiplexing was used, so you could have multiple operators sending multiple messages over one cable. So it was using time division multiplexing, but very innovative, just a rotor kind of system.
Yeah.
And so I mean they could push more messages through the cable, so partly they didn't need to lay anymore. But there was also an element that there's certainly one or two scholars would say that there was an element that after the War of Independence and the Civil War, there was a lot of disruption to telecoms, and the stations were during the Civil War, the stations were attacked and put out rendered inoperable, and that there was a fear then of basically terrorism in Ireland, and Ireland was avoided for a long time. And when the first transatlantic telephone cable was laid in the late 50s, it was laid to Scotland, not Ireland.
Well, wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, again, I suppose the technology had improved a little bit, so the amplification had started, so the transmission loss wasn't quite such the issue it had been in the 1850s and 1860s, but it felt that there was a political reason for that as well.
And at what point did transatlantic radio become a factor?
So that was in the early part of the 20th century, and Marconi, possibly because of his Irish connection, did a few experiments in Ireland. So there was the first kind of record, you know, radio transmissions took place from Rathlin Island to Ballycastle on the mainland of County Antrim. And then he also did the first sporting kind of coverage was done when he around the same time he just left County Antrim for a little while, traveled down to Dublin or to Dunleary more specifically, and covered the Kingstown Regatta. And he hired a boat and went out into the bay, and he could send by Morse messages back to the harbour master's house in Dunleary, and then they were phoned into it was sponsored by a newspaper. And they were phoned into the newspaper office. And newspapers, so not only were they printing the paper, but they would put them up in the window, and it was quite a big thing at the time to have like live sports coverage.
That's brilliant, isn't it?
And then he kept his interest in Ireland. So the cables were, you know, were there was multiple cables, but the companies kind of operated a cartel. So it's still quite expensive to send a telegram between Europe and North America. So Marconi thought he could undercut that by using Morse, by using a wireless radio transmission. And he set up a station in Clifton, and that transmitted with the corresponding one in Newfoundland. And that operated for many years, from I think 1907, I think it opened commercially. But again, it closed. The Civil War seemed to have kind of done for it. It was destroyed in the Civil War, and it seemed that the new Free State government wasn't all that interested in keeping it. Some elements regarded Marconi, because although Marconi was Italian and of partly of Irish origin, the company he founded largely was headquartered in England, and it was perceived as quite a British company by 1922. And it seemed that some elements of the new government were so anti-British they'd be happily let 200 jobs in a very remote part of Connemara go down the tubes, because rather than have a British company there.
Yeah, and it's funny. And I mean, I know that Marconi company survived in name up into, let's say, the 80s anyway. It was Marconi Elliott. So, like, it's a tremendous heritage. So if we just move on, then after the establishment of the Irish state, it was not well off, and it was a rural state. And
yes.
For many years, probably underinvestment.
The new government it didn't inherit a huge, so Kerry had that, you know, global centre for the telegraphs. But for the rest of the network wasn't in a fantastic state, because I suppose Ireland was quite a poor part of the UK, and, you know, it was very much led by the demand. There wasn't much demand, so there wasn't much infrastructure, and a vicious circle kind of appeared there. And the new government didn't really do it. I mean, there wasn't a lot of money around, but they didn't seem to target the money on telecoms. It just wasn't a priority. Mm-hmm. And there's a bit of analysis. One was, there's a man called Leon O'Brien who was the I think the secretary in the Department of Post and Telegraphs for decades, and has written a memoir and seemed to be, you know, a very astute and clever man. And he sort of said that the minister, you know, the minister for Post and Telegraphs was always was basically a boy who was bullied. They were always kind of slightly typically non-entities who, you know, they were appointed, I suppose, by a Taoiseach because the Taoiseach didn't regard the Department of Post and Telegraphs as terribly important. So appointed someone maybe for, you know, geographical rather needs or whatever, political needs rather than their expertise in anything. And they just got pushed around. And they didn't stand up. Anyway, the investment really wasn't made. So the country just lagged behind. And, you know, I mean, you could understand there was need for housing and everything. But, you know, it really did seem by the 60s, it really was quite an embarrassment because you now had a change in policy where you were trying to encourage inward investment. And, you know, so you'd have multinational companies, but the multinational company would barely be able to get a call across the other side of town, never mind a call to headquarters. Mm-hmm. There was an opportunity missed really from during the 60s in particular to like take the bull by the horns. And it really was 1979 was the pivotal moment where I think following a series of strikes, I think the phone system just was absolute liability. Apparently by the late 70s, half of Dáil time was taken up by questions about the phone service. And it would be typically stuff like, can the minister say when Mrs. Murphy of Ballygobacquers, who applied for her phone in 1975, is likely to get service? And that's, you know, it's a way, you know, I think everybody realized this is just a waste of time.
No, I remember like when we were young, my dad applied for a phone. I think it took 2 years. This is in Dublin.
I know.
So, and it's so just for people, there was a huge investment, I think it was the French E10 system. Was, you know, implemented in the network in the 79, early 80s.
And you say the French, I mean, so it was roughly half Alcatel E10 and half of Ericsson XE.
Oh, okay, Ericsson, yeah.
That's interesting because they had PNT had a fairly long tradition, you know, with Ericsson. And had, I mean, to be fair, well, there was a lot of, you know, it was largely underinvestment. They did occasionally get things right. And for example, they moved to Crossbar fairly early. So they moved from Stroud, they kind of abandoned Stroud in the late 50s, whereas the British and the Germans and so on were still happily putting it in. And they put in a Crossbar switch when Limerick went automatic in the late 50s. And they had a, you know, between that and other stuff, they had quite a good relationship with Ericsson. So well, the French, getting Alcatel in was interesting, but there was quite a few French ideas borrowed at the time. So one of them was even how the investment was made. So when Telecom Air was set up, what they had, there was a kind of finance wing of it, which would buy the equipment, which would get money at market rates from the private sector, buy the equipment and then lease it back to Telecom Air. So it didn't. So the government wasn't looking for its own money to put in, and therefore it kept it off the kind of the government balance sheet, which in the 80s were in dark
like
straits.
Special purpose vehicle.
Yeah, well. Yeah.
No, that's that's very innovative and you know admirable. It's now actually I would say my own feeling. Ericsson also established this big center in Athlone and other centers. And there was thousands of Irish people who went through that. And my own instinct is a lot of skills and knowledge of telecoms from an engineering and marketing point of view was due to the Ericsson experience that many people went on to establish or join other companies, which made Ireland in some respects a mini hub of telecom innovation in the 90s and forward.
I have a story. We've gone to mobile about like Aldiscon and SMSEs and so on.
I've to be honest, Aldiscon's been a big topic on this podcast. So let's get on to mobile. So the magic wand arrived where everyone had a communicator a la Star Trek, and this was amazing, wasn't it?
This was but also because of, I think Ireland, we suddenly skipped from being like behind to being ahead of the pack when mobile arrived, because and partly it seems that because the landline network was so underdeveloped that people had just got used to doing without. So even by the early 90s, by which they, you know, the waiting lists have been cleared and the network was you know, now we're completely modernized and so on, the phone, it was still relatively expensive. Like compared to other countries, that Telecom Aaron knew how to charge and did. So still quite expensive. And there was this, I suspect, a legacy thought of that people had done without it for years. So they didn't, not everybody got a phone in, even though you didn't need to wait anymore. And so there was quite a lot of unserved need. It said that like when the mobile, when Aircel was created in 1985, and the original plan or the marketing product plan was for 1,000 subscribers with one cell site on Three Rock Mountain. But that quickly it went way over that, and it wasn't, you know, the Gordon Gekko type stockbroker shouting orders down the phone. It was actually stuff like builders, tradesmen, site offices on building sites, which were always notoriously difficult to get a phone into, because in the olden days, when you'd wait 4 years, the building works would have finished by the time the phone line was put in. So they just moved to mobile immediately because it was just much easier. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it kind of caught on in Ireland. And what I credit as the key is, although I begin the chapter with the bid for what became ESAT Digiphone being delivered to the Department of Communications with great flourish in a very Dennis O'Brien kind of way with Vikings and violins and so on, that actually it was the rivaled in terms of the incumbent with Stephen Brewer at the helm, and that around the just soon after ESAT Digiphone was launched, Aircel launched Ready to Go. And again, they were quite early. There was only about two other, I think Portugal and Italy, the operators there had brought in prepaid with some success. But suddenly this meant that, you know, that whole risk of having a phone, that idea that you could be landed with a big bill, that whole risk was taken away. You could walk in and walk out of a shop with a phone. You could gift it to someone. So
on a personal story, Derek, I was working in Aircel at the time, and I wasn't working on the Ready to Go project, but I do remember being in Stephen's office when a marketing woman came in with the blister pack for the analog 088 Ready to Go phone at £99, and I remember thinking, how can they sell it at £99? I mean, I thought it was fantastic. It was, I forget, it was maybe £10 or £20 a month top up. Eventually I was involved in the top up side. And it was, I forget the exact statistics, but say within a year, in fairness to Digicel, that they were soon after on the pack.
Oh, yeah, yeah, I was there. We launched Speakeasies soon after.
Yeah, but there was probably a million between Aircel and Digiphone. There was probably a million prepaid within 18 months.
I'd say. Exactly. You know,
it was
exactly,
just outstanding. Yeah. And it was, let me just tell you a little bit of a backroom story. Was when Stephen launched Ready to Go, he was trying to pip Digiphone, and they couldn't charge for SMS. So they launched it with free SMS, which was seen as a marketing stroke of marketing genius. Yeah. The truth was they couldn't charge it took off, and then they started charging. But anyway, you know, I'm sure it's the same on your side.
Yeah. I actually think we blocked maybe SMS, because I can remember being in the O2 still Digiphone call center in Limerick for a meeting on the day that SMS was turned on for prepaid. And the call queues were, there were these wall boards that gave the queue times and so on, and they were really high. And I knew how somebody explained to me how to read them, and you could just knew it was quite busy. And I was going, what's going on? Is there a network problem? No. And you could just hear all this one. No, you can actually send the messages. It's not just from voicemail. You can send, you know, because that's all SMS had been up to around that point, was the voicemail system.
Sure.
But people, people were now sending messages to one another, and people were receiving them and going, what do I do with this?
I apologize to anyone who's younger than us.
Yeah.
Back in those days, you'd have to tap out the message on the numeric keypad on the phone. And I remember when before it was actually launched, a very senior marketing person doing that and saying, this is the most ridiculous thing ever. It'll never take off. And what a misread of what teenagers are willing to do to send a message.
I know.
It was really amazing. And I reproduced the diagram from your book. It was a publicly available diagram, and tagged Stephen Brewer on it. And he was thrilled. He just thought this was so fantastic. So thanks, Derek. So I just thought this was a very interesting point, because I hadn't thought about it. The internet in Ireland, what do you suggest was one of the main drivers of interest in the internet?
I suggest it was Ryanair.
I think you're right.
Yeah, Ryanair launched their online booking engine in February 2000, just after the start of the millennium. They were relatively early. Aer Lingus certainly weren't doing it. A few other airlines had done it, but it was more as an adjunct to just the traditional way. I mean, again, for the benefit of younger listeners, how you used to book a plane ticket was you typically walked into a travel agent. They used to be situated on streets, and you said, "I'd like to fly to London, please." And they looked up the computer themselves, and they just kind of give you some options. And then you said, "Okay, I'll take that one, please." And you handed them maybe cash and whatever, and then you walked out of the shop with a paper ticket.
Sounds like you described oil lamps and pony and traps
when you think about it now compared to the way the aviation industry works. So those travel agents paid a handsome commission for doing that, and that's how Ryanair worked as well. But Michael O'Leary, I think, you know, saw that maybe they could muscle that for some of their ticket sales. They could sell direct and get them out. And I think it was when EasyJet started doing it that he decided, okay, I'll do the same. But you know, Ryanair been Ryanair. So Eddie Wilson, who's now actually the head of the airline, I think Michael O'Leary's chair or whatever, had just started as HR director. And he'd come from Gateway just down the road in Clonchock, and he had been involved there in setting up an intranet, remember them, to connect up the different Gateway sites. And there had been a 15-year-old there working in the summer, called John Beckett, and he'd done the internet and seemed to be quite a whiz on you know, those kind of protocols. And he asked him, would he be interested in developing an online booking engine for them? So John Beckett got a slightly older friend of his, and the two of them wrote basically the code for a website over the millennium, while the rest of us were all worried about Y2K and parties. They were writing this website, and they launched it Ryanair launched it in February 2000. And you know, there were polls done of Irish people and their attitude to internet and internet commerce, and say in 1999 I think 84% of people or some figure like that said that they wouldn't buy anything with their credit card online. And suddenly Ryanair automatically, it was £5 cheaper if you bought online. And it took off like wildfire. And as they say, you know, Mary Murphy in Ballybackwards discovered that she could visit her friend or her sister in London for £15 if she bought the tickets online. And suddenly the market just flipped. And we went from, you know, quite low down in internet adoption compared to our peers to being up at the top, and particularly in terms of e-commerce on airlines. We almost led the pack.
That's great. And like, I when you put it that way, I think you've nailed it, to be honest. That's the most fantastic use case for the internet. And I mean, I have to say, the airline sector in Ireland, is the amount of innovators in the airline sector is just world class. So it's
we punch above our weight in that. How the aircraft leasing sector will deal with all their planes in Russia is a question.
But okay, look, Derek, that's absolutely fantastic, and thanks for taking the time to talk to us. On this podcast, we ask the guests if they have a piece of music they'd like to play it on. So do you have anything?
I do. I'm just going to set the context here. You know, we spoke about 1979 and a huge investment program. So I think it was 1980, then the minister, there was a reshuffle, and Albert Reynolds became Minister of Posts and Telegraphs. And he wasn't, I think he was minister for only about 18 months, but he's very much associated, I was a child at the time, and I very much associated him with being out there, you know, cutting every ribbon on a telephone exchange or a telephone booth. So he was very much that he saw this as his own project. And there was a scene on the television of at some, I think it was a Fianna Fáil party or something like this, some function where he sang on stage and it kind of almost...
I think I know this video.
Yes, and he sang, "Put your sweet lips a little close to the phone."
I think that's the most embarrassing play-out song we ever got, Derek, but I still play.
So I have to say, it's not necessarily one of my favourite songs, but I think it's quite appropriate.
And for people who are abroad, Albert Reynolds eventually became our Taoiseach, our Prime Minister, so it wasn't like he was an inconsequential politician. So.
No, absolutely not. But he ran, he'd run a set of ballrooms around the Midlands of the country. So he knew a bit about singing and music and whatever. Yeah.
Fair enough. And where can people get the book, Derek?
So the book is available, if you want to go old school, it's available in most major bookstores in Ireland, places like Dubray, Hodges Figgis, and Waterstones have it. Some branches of Easton's have it, some of the bigger independent stores around the country have it, and it's also available online. And just to call out one in particular, Kenny's.ie in Galway have it at a nice price, but other online retailers are available.
Brilliant. Okay, so here comes Albert, and thanks, Derek, for a really fantastic podcast. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you, Pat.
Can you tell us anything about him at all?
Well, I know some things about him already.
We've been told he might be an Iranian.
I don't think so. You
don't think so?
Is he Larry Downey Minister?
What, an Irishman?
I think he's an Irishman, but I'm not certain yet.
Has he made any demands, apart from wanting to go to Tehran?
The publication of the third Secret of Fatima.
What on earth is that?
It's a religious writing.
That's a religious secret, it's not for me to say what it is.
Put your sweet lips a little closer to the phone. Let's pretend that we're together all alone. I'll tell the man to turn the jukebox way down low. And you can tell your friend there with you he'll have to go. Whisper to me, tell me, do you love me true? Or is he holding you the way I do? Though love is blind, make up your mind, I've got to know. Should I hang up, or will you tell him he'll have to go? You can't say the words I want to hear while you're with another man. Do you want me answer yes or no? Darling, I will understand. Put your sweet lips a little closer to the phone. Let's pretend that we're together all alone. I'll tell the man to turn the jukebox way down low. And you can tell your friend there with you you'll have to